Today's reading of the Washington Post is made available by the Talking Information Center in Massachusetts. Learn more at ticnetwork.org.
This is Anne reading from the Washington Post on Wednesday, April 17th. They quit liberal public schools, now they teach kids to be anti-woke. By Hannah Natanson. Callie Fontanilla repeated the lesson title to herself one last time, A Complete History of Slavery in America, sipped her peppermint tea and hit record. Hello, Exodus students, she said, addressing the group of 95th through 12th graders who would eventually watch the video as part of their lessons from the Exodus Institute, an online Christian K-12 school Kaylee and her husband founded in 2021 with the motto, Exit Public Education. The video, which Kaylee was recording in her guest bedroom turned office, was the latest in a special enrichment program dubbed the Young Patriots Academy, which aims to debunk the woke lies taught in most public schools, per the Exodus website. Kaylee, who is half black and half white, had a particular target that Friday, what she calls the left's unquestioning advocacy of reparations, the theory that the government should pay restitution to descendants of enslaved Americans. She told her virtual students they were about to learn of the Quakers and how white members of that religion helped fight slavery. She said that throughout American history, there were good people and bad people, but focusing only on the bad, like she believes many public school teachers do, would be wrong. Whenever you learn history, she said, it is important to learn the full context of it. Haley's online job marked a sharp departure from the years she and her husband, Joshua Fontanilla, spent teaching middle and high school English in California's Deep Blue Salinas District. The couple quit their jobs a year after the coronavirus pandemic began, disillusioned by school shutdowns and displeased by some colleagues' embrace of the Black Lives Matter movement, which both thought was wrong-headed and hateful for what they saw as its anti-police stance. Kaylee, 41, and Joshua, who is 42 and of Mexican and Puerto Rican descent, had also grown convinced their school system was teaching harmful ideas about race and history, including what they believe is the false theory America is systemically racist. Across the nation, mostly conservative mothers and fathers were raising similar alarms, anxiety that soon fueled an explosion of legislation restricting how educators can teach about race, sex, and gender. By April 2024, such laws had spread to affect half the nation's students. The claim that public schools teach left-wing indoctrination, not education, had become commonplace on the right, repeated by parents, politicians, and pundits, but not usually by teachers, and that's why the Fontanillas felt compelled to act. They came direct from the classroom. They had seen firsthand what was happening. Now they wanted to expose the propaganda they felt had infiltrated public schools and offer families an alternative. In 2021, eager to fulfill their mission, the couple moved to Florida to found their own Christian school in a state which, under Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, had become a haven for people with views like theirs. In the years since, they have grown their school to nearly 200 students, partly through Kaylee's appearances on conservative media like Fox News, but mostly through her social media. Kaylee's Instagram videos, filled with right-wing rhetoric and delivered almost daily to her 333,000 followers, proved a powerful recruiting tool. But they also spurred thousands of critical messages from online observers who contended she was indoctrinating students into a skewed conservative worldview. Racist, one-sided, whitewashed opinion, one wrote in a recent post, just above someone else who declared, "No one is impressed by the trash you are trying to sell." Now, half an hour into her lesson on slavery, Kaylee told students how some Quakers risked prison time to assist people fleeing enslavement. There are certain people that are saying, oh, white people owe black people for slavery, Kaylee said. But what about the white people who were descendants of the Quakers who actually had a lot of negative consequences that happened to them for helping free the slaves? She urged her students to keep pondering the question as they turned to their next assignment. Kaylee was a few years into studying for her master's degree in education at the University of California at Santa Cruz when she recalled a professor told her class to take a privilege walk. He formed the students into a line, Kaylee said, and asked a series of questions. Have you ever seen a play? What about a concert? Students stepped forward if the answer was yes, backward if the answer was no. Kaylee hated it. Although she came from a challenging background, her Jamaican father left her white mother early on, she said, and the family was always strapped for money. She wound up standing ahead of wealthier white classmates because her grandmother had insisted she be exposed to the arts. And she couldn't believe the professor didn't ask about sexual abuse. Even if you are the richest young person, white, whatever, if you've been sexually abused, that's the worst trauma you could ever receive, Kaylee said. A spokesman for UC Santa Cruz confirmed Kaylee attended the school, but said he could not easily verify anything beyond that. Years later, teaching English in Salinas, she was horrified when she saw other teachers giving students a privilege quiz during a ninth grade ethnic studies class. Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat, signed a law making ethnic studies a statewide requirement about a year later. Curious and worried, Kaylee looked up the ethnic studies lesson plans in the school's internal systems and found evidence some colleagues were using the class to introduce students to critical race theory, a college-level academic framework that holds racism is baked into American institutions. Kaylee encountered the theory in graduate school and loathed it, fearing it would convert students into victims who lay blame on racist systems rather than accept any individual responsibility. In the ethnic studies class, teachers were urging students to study school policies through a critical race theory framework, according to screenshots of a presentation that Kaylee shared with the Washington Post, meaning they should analyze how race affects our experiences. Students were told to take three steps against hegemony, per the PowerPoint, analyze hidden curriculum, use critical race theory, be active participants. Asked about the ethnic studies course, district officials wrote in a statement that embedded in the lesson outcomes was the question for students to analyze whether or not race may be viewed as a contributor to one's experiences. The district surveyed students who completed the class in 2022, officials wrote, and their feedback was overwhelmingly positive. Around the same time, Joshua Fontanilla said he was also spotting what he perceived as bias at school. His suspicions stirred, he said, when he noticed his high school always announced meetings of the Gay Straight Alliance Club over the loudspeakers, but not those of other clubs, like his chess group. Joshua then began combing through the American Dream unit of the English curriculum, researching the politics of every author. He concluded that too many, at least 12 of 19, were left-leaning, including, as Joshua saw it, leftist historians Studs Terkel, socialist poet Langston Hughes, and Dem Walt Whitman. District officials wrote in a statement that there is no evidence nor complaint ever brought forward regarding inequity in clubs being recognized during the announcements, and noted that the English curriculum conforms to California state standards. Officials added that the Fontanillas never made a complaint formally or informally to any district official. A decade ago, Kaylee and Joshua said they would have agreed with what their school was teaching. Both were raised in a blue slice of California by what they described as liberal families, and for a long time accepted those views without question. When Sarah Taylor hired Kaylee to tutor her son in 2012, Kaylee was definitely left-leaning in her politics, Taylor recalled. But Taylor, a Santa Cruz area mother of two and self-professed independent, didn't care. She just knew Kaylee was good for her son, who was struggling to read and focus. Under Kaylee's tutelage, Taylor said, the boy's reading skills and academic performance soared. She still remembers how Kaylee let him run around the block whenever he got antsy. She just really got the fact he was a young little boy who had a lot of energy, Taylor said. He's a sophomore in college and an amazing student now, and he wouldn't be without her. By the time Kaylee finished tutoring Taylor's son, she and Joshua had begun to reconsider their Democratic allegiances. Kaylee grew disillusioned with President Barack Obama when he signed a 2014 law cutting $8.7 billion in food stamps, a benefit that she, her mother, and two siblings relied on throughout her childhood, she said. Joshua came to realize he agreed with many of President Donald Trump's policies, including his hardline stance on immigration. And both were disgusted with liberal politicians' response to the pandemic, especially their willingness to shut down schools, which Kaylee and Joshua believed should have been last to close. The couple's concerns over curriculums, most notably the ethnic studies class, was the final straw. In summer 2021, her mind made up, Kaylee wrote a letter to the school board. If the district continues to move forward with all these divisive teachings, it will only harden the hearts of many of our students, she wrote in the letter, which the superintendent read aloud at a June board meeting after she submitted it for public comment. I have decided to resign from the district, which is the only reason I feel brave enough to speak out without fear of repercussions. At the board meeting, following the letter reading, several students gave speeches in favor of the ethnic studies course that helped prompt Kaylee's resignation. I would like to be able to learn my people's history at schools, said one student, noting she is of Mexican and Latina heritage. I feel like ethnic studies unites us more because we have a new understanding, another student told a local reporter. It makes us understand why certain stereotypes are in our communities and how to fix them. But Kaylee wasn't there to hear them. Before that summer ended, she and Joshua packed their bags, put their chihuahua in a travel crate, and headed for the Sunshine State. The couple cashed out their California teacher retirement pensions to start up Exodus, and more than 2 years later, the school is just profitable enough to break even. Students pay between $2,000 and $8,000 based on need for the standard K-12 offerings at Exodus, which include lessons on a wide variety of subjects, including math, science, horticulture, French, business, and the Christian faith. The Fontanillas said their students' body is 50% Hispanic and Black and 60% non-Christian. The degree Exodus confers counts as a regular high school diploma. Kaylee and Joshua said the K-12 curriculum and accredited status come courtesy of Southlands Christian Schools, a 45-year-old private school located in California that in the past 5 years spun up an online faith-based schooling program. Joshua said he discovered Southlands in 2019 at an event for the California chapter of Blexit, a right-wing commentator Candace Owens' campaign to make Black Americans leave the Democratic Party. At the event, Joshua met Joshua Duncan, an employee of Cornerstone Education Management Organization, Inc., the company Southlands pays to manage the logistics of its online schooling arm, including hiring teachers and finding people like the Fontanillas who want to start their own schools. The two Joshuas hit it off, and eventually the Fontanillas won approval to launch the Exodus Institute. Josh and Kaylee are good people. They have a good message. There is definitely a market for what they're doing, Duncan said. Under the deal, the Fontanillas use the Southlands standard K-12 curriculum and teachers provided by Cornerstone. Tuition payments go directly to the companies and the Fontanillas get a commission for every pupil, Duncan said. The Fontanillas also offered their Young Patriots Academy, which Kaylee leads, as a special enrichment program. Classes cost $29 a month and revolve around topics of the couple's choosing. The first class asked, the America dream, is it just a dream? There's actually people in America, and some of them are teachers, that are teaching kids that the American dream is not real, Kaylee said in that video, which she shared with the Post. We're going to look at that and see if that's true or not. Kaylee and Joshua declined to make students and parents available for interviews, citing worries over privacy, but shared screenshots of enrollees' reviews of academy lessons. I love, love, love your teaching, Ms. Fontanilla, one student wrote. It is so encouraging that you explain and exposing the stupid things on the internet in a logical way. The couple have ambitions to scale up. Kaylee and Joshua hope to eventually cross 1,000 students, at which point they calculate they will no longer have to pursue side jobs like Kaylee's current gig as a senior fellow at the Capital Research Center, a conservative think tank. So far, Kaylee has found most success attracting clients through Instagram, despite the fact her account is regularly suspended for community violations, she said. The more right-wing and out there Kaylee's commentary, the more attention and family she draws to Exodus, she said. In one recent video, she complained that Black History Month has turned into Black Idolatry Month. In another, she exhorted her followers to be preppers and stock up on food and medicine in case all hell breaks loose after what she predicted will be Trump's victory in November. But the videos also inspire hate. Messages by the dozen every day telling Kaylee to shut up, according to screenshots she shared with the Post. Online commentators regularly sling racial slurs and derogatory names. Slave sellout roach, dumb fucking bitch, wish.com Candace Owen, Auntie Tomella. The harassment got so bad last year that, coupled with her chihuahua's death and an injury that prevented her daily workouts, it proved too much for Kaylee. She went into a depressive spiral and had to take a break from social media. She barely managed to film her lessons. Joshua and her faith pulled her through. Kaylee said she was raised Seventh-day Adventist. Joshua discovered the religion online after researching dozens of faiths. Their beliefs also brought the couple together. They met in their 20s through a Seventh-day Adventist dating website. The enforced quiet of their religion's Sabbath had proved healing for the couple. Close to sunset, almost every Friday, the Fontanillas took a walk by the water to usher in their 24 hours of rest, during which they were supposed to refrain from schoolwork, housework, and social media. On a recent Friday, they strolled hand in hand through a grassy park with ocean views. Joshua led the way to a bench, tapping the space beside him. Walking over to join him, Kaylee passed a series of posters featuring student artwork erected every spring as part of a public art installation. This year's iteration included a painting of a book in chains and another of a student wearing earrings that each bore the slogan, "Ask me about my pronouns." It was just one more reason, Kaylee told herself, to pray. She sat beside her husband and closed her eyes. Together they bent their heads to thank God. Back in the guest bedroom office, Kaylee prepared to finish out her lesson on slavery, reparations, and the Quakers. She told her students how Quakers formed some of the first anti-slavery organizations in American history, how Quakers boycotted sugar, cotton, and other goods produced through slave labor. She spoke about how Quakers lacked official clergy and advocated spiritual equality for men and women. She did not mention that 19th century slaveholding Quakers sometimes offered financial compensation to the enslaved people they freed, or that in 2022, British Quakers committed to make reparations for their past involvement in the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism. Asked about this, Kaylee said in an interview that she knows not all Quakers were perfect and that some owned slaves, but that her lesson was meant to give a contrast and a balance to the overemphasis on reparations coming from the left. She also noted that some Quakers have become very left-leaning now. The most important thing to know about the Quakers, Kaylee told her class that Friday, is they lived out their values. They put their values into practice. Everything the Quakers did, from what they ate to where they shopped to how they prayed, upheld their values. And what does that mean, to actually live your values, she asked. Kaylee smiled as she told her students to write down their answers. She knew her own. Supreme Court divided over key charge against January 6th rioters and Trump by Ann E. Marimow. The Supreme Court appeared deeply divided Tuesday over whether prosecutors improperly stretched federal law to charge hundreds of participants in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, a decision that will impact those rioters and potentially Donald Trump's election interference trial in D.C. The court's conservatives, who make up a majority on the 9-member bench, appeared most skeptical of the government's decision to charge participants under a law that makes it a crime to obstruct or impede an official proceeding. In this case, the joint session of Congress that convened to formally certify Joe Biden's 2020 presidential victory. Several, including Justices Neil M. Gorsuch and Samuel A. Alito, Jr., expressed concern through hypothetical scenarios about giving prosecutors broad power that they suggest would allow the government to target peaceful protesters, disruptive hecklers, or someone who pulls a fire alarm to delay a vote in Congress. Are all those federal felonies subject to 20 years in prison? Gorsuch asked. More than 350 people have been prosecuted under the statute, which was enacted after the exposure of massive fraud and destruction of documents during the collapse of the energy giant Enron, and carries a maximum sentence of 20 years. More than 100 have pleaded guilty to or been convicted under the statute. The court's ruling has the potential to unwind their convictions and sentences, most of which were well under 20 years, and upend the charges still pending for other defendants. Three January 6th defendants have had their sentences reduced ahead of a decision by the Supreme Court. The court's decision, expected by late June or early July, could also further delay Trump's already stalled trial for allegedly trying to remain in power after his 2020 defeat. Two of the four charges he faces are based on the obstruction statute, and he could move to have those charges dismissed if the Supreme Court rules for the rioters. Justice Clarence Thomas, who was back in court after an unexplained absence Monday, repeatedly asked whether the Justice Department had ever used the obstruction statute against other violent protesters, suggesting that the government was engaging in selective prosecution. There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings. Has the government applied this provision to other protests in the past? Thomas asked. Democratic lawmakers had urged the justice not to participate in the January 6th case because of efforts by his wife, Virginia Ginny Thomas, to overturn Biden's victory. Solicitor General Elizabeth B. Prelogar, defending the government, said she could not provide an example in which others had violently stormed a building to block an official proceeding, in part because I'm not aware of that circumstance ever happening prior to January 6th. Justice Sonia Sotomayor seemed to reinforce that point when she later said, "We've never had a situation before where there's been a situation like this with people attempting to stop proceedings violently, so I'm not sure what a lack of history proves." Much of the discussion Tuesday centered on how to properly interpret the text of a statute in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act passed by Congress in 2002, after the Enron scandal. The meaning of the word otherwise appeared key as the justices discussed how narrowly or broadly prosecutors can apply the statute. The law applies to anyone who corruptly 1. Alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so, with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in official proceeding, or 2. Otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding, or attempts to do so. Prelogar told the justices that the second clause should be read as a catch-all that prohibits unanticipated methods of impeding an official proceeding, such as occupying the Capitol building, enforcing the suspension of Congress's joint session, certifying the election results. The word otherwise means in a different manner, she said. Only two justices, Elena Kagan and Sotomayor, seemed to fully embrace the Justice Department's position. Kagan said Congress intentionally used broad language as a backstop for other potential types of obstruction. Sotomayor agreed, suggesting that it was a straightforward question. I don't see why that's not the backstop that Congress would have intended, and it's the language it used. The case was brought by Joseph W. Fisher, an off-duty Pennsylvania police officer, who attended the January 6th Stop the Steal rally and entered the Capitol that day. Fisher's trial was put on hold while he challenged the decision to charge him with obstructing Congress, one of seven counts he faces, including assaulting a federal officer in the police line outside the Capitol. Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh sounded skeptical of the government's approach when he rattled off the other charges against Fisher and asked the Solicitor General why the government needed to include obstruction. He also noted the lengthy maximum penalty. Why aren't those six counts good enough just from the Justice Department's perspective, given that they don't have any of the hurdles, he asked. Perloger said the average sentence for those already convicted under the statute is 26 months, not 20 years. In Fisher's case, she said, the obstruction charge was necessary to fully account for his alleged conduct. He was prepared to storm the Capitol, prepared to use violence. He wanted to intimidate Congress, Perloger said. He said they can't vote if they can't breathe. And then he went to the Capitol on January 6th with that intent in mind and took action, including assaulting a law enforcement officer. A divided panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit upheld the obstruction charge against Fisher, who then appealed to the Supreme Court. In arguing the case known as Fisher v. U.S., lawyer Jeffrey T. Green urged the court to reject the government's broad interpretation of the statute, warning that it would unleash a 20-year maximum penalty on potential peaceful protests. Green said the two sections of the statute must be read together. The obstruction measure is all about preserving the availability of evidence, he argued, as well as Congress's interest in protecting the integrity of an investigation or other official proceeding. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. seemed to agree, suggesting the second section of this statute is defined for what precedes it and cannot be read on its own. He preferred Perloger to unanimous opinion released by the court Friday and written by Roberts. That decision, in a case involving workers' rights and arbitration, restated the principle that more general catch-all terms are controlled and defined by reference to the terms that precede it. You can't just tack it on and say, look at it as if that's a standing alone, because it's not, Roberts told Perloger, referring to the government's broader use of the law. Two other justices, Amy Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson, seemed interested in limiting the ways in which the government can use the statute so that it would apply only to evidence-related obstruction, but without automatically derailing hundreds of January 6th cases. Barrett asked Fisher's lawyers whether prosecutors could try to prove his client did interfere with evidence by trying to prevent electoral vote certificates from being counted at the desk of Vice President Mike Pence. What if, Barrett suggested, the goal was to shut down the proceeding and therefore interfere with the evidence reaching the Vice President? Green acknowledged it's a closer question, but insisted that Congress was prohibiting only altering documents or other evidence, not merely delaying their dissemination. Although Trump's name was not mentioned during oral argument, the obstruction charges against him are based in part on allegations that he schemed with others to submit to Congress slates of phony electors from swing states and to get lawmakers to toss out lawful ballots. Even if the Supreme Court decides the obstruction charge does not apply to the actions of the rioters, the special counsel prosecuting Trump's case has told the High Court that the charges should still be valid against Trump. 14 of the 15 judges overseeing January 6th related cases in the D.C. federal courthouse have ruled in favor of the government's use of the obstruction charge, saying that the rioters who sought to keep Congress from certifying Biden's victory were otherwise obstructing that proceeding. The outlier was U.S. District Judge Carl J. Nichols, a Trump nominee, who ruled for Fisher and said the word otherwise refers only to other efforts to tamper with or destroy records or documents. A divided D.C. circuit reversed that ruling, which Judge Florence Pan, a Biden nominee, said was too narrow and at odds with the text of the statute. We cannot assume and think it unlikely that Congress used expansive language to address such narrow concerns, she wrote, joined in part by Judge Justin Walker, who was nominated by Trump. Judge Gregory Katsas, who also nominated by Trump, dissented, writing that a broad reading of the statute would put law-abiding activities like lobbying and protest at risk. Several justices picked up on those concerns and noted Katsas' reasoning Tuesday morning. Alito asked Prologar what would happen if five people stood up in the ornate, hushed courtroom and shouted either that the January 6th defendants were insurrectionists who should go to jail or are patriots and should be set free, delaying the oral argument proceedings for 5 minutes. Would that be a violation of the obstruction law? Alito asked. The Solicitor General told Alito his hypothetical was fundamentally different from what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. A more similar scenario, she said, would be if protesters stormed into the courtroom, overwhelmed Supreme Court police, and forced justices and other participants to flee for their safety. Alito answered, absolutely. What happened January 6th was very, very serious. I'm not equating this with that. But we need to find what are the outer reaches of the statute under your interpretation. Foreign aid plan fuels bid to oust Johnson. By Mariana Sotomayor and Elihi Ann Caldwell. House Speaker Mike Johnson's job is in serious jeopardy as two far-right lawmakers are threatening to oust him after the embattled Republican leader proposed a complex plan intended to fund key foreign allies during wartime. Johnson, Louisiana, introduced a four-part proposal Monday night to decouple aid for Israel, which faced a barrage of missiles and drones from Iran over the weekend, and help for Ukraine in its fight against Russia, along with two other measures. But his angry right flank, which has for weeks threatened to wrest Johnson's gavel, escalated its attacks Tuesday morning, also vowing to sink a procedural measure needed to consider his plan. During a weekly Republican meeting Tuesday morning, Representative Thomas Massey, Kentucky, upped the ante when he stood and called on Johnson to resign after announcing that he had signed on to Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's plan to depose him, known as a motion to vacate. That means that if Democrats choose not to rescue Johnson, Republicans would need just a simple majority to oust the second speaker in 6 months, causing the House to descend further into chaos during an election year when their slender grasp on the majority is at stake. Republicans appear seriously divided not only about the possible effort to eject Johnson, but also on the foreign aid bills, especially the Ukraine aid that a strident faction staunchly opposes. Massey said he had warned the speaker in a private conversation weeks ago that if the motion to oust him was called to the floor and Democrats did not help bail him out, Republicans would be successful in removing him as speaker because we're steering everything toward what Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wants. The motion is going to get called, okay? Does anybody doubt that? The motion will get called, and then he's going to lose more votes than Kevin McCarthy, Massey said, referencing the previous GOP speaker who lost the gavel when eight Republicans joined all Democrats to oust him in October. I am not resigning, Johnson said defiantly at a news conference Tuesday, calling the threat absurd as Republicans are trying to do their job. We need steady leadership. We need steady hands on the wheel, he said. Look, I regard myself as a wartime speaker. The effort to remove Johnson, if Green, Republican Georgia, moved ahead, would further divide an already fractured conference that has proved extraordinarily difficult to manage. House Republicans made history by ousting one speaker in the last year and have struggled to pass conservative legislation as far-right members protest bills that don't meet their tests for ideological purity. The GOP's inability to compromise has weakened the speaker's hand in negotiations with the Democratic-led Senate and White House, leading Johnson to insist repeatedly that House Republicans can do only so much with one lever of power. Johnson called President Biden on Monday evening to brief him on the details of his proposal, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said. He also read in Senate Majority Leader Charles E. Schumer, Democrat New York, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, ahead of time. The Speaker's proposal, according to multiple sources, mirrors the Senate-passed $95 billion national security bill, which includes $60 billion in new funds for Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel, $9 billion in humanitarian assistance to Gaza, and $5 billion to bolster Indo-Pacific allies against Chinese threats. Johnson plans to add another bill, including Republican national security priorities, such as the seizure of Russian assets, and a House-approved bill that could ban TikTok from the United States, among other measures. But the uproar from Republicans has sent Johnson back to the drawing board, and it's unclear what the final text will look like. It is not helpful to the cause. It is not helpful to the country. It does not help House Republicans advance our agenda, Johnson said about the disruption by his members, including the possible move to topple him. Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican Louisiana, also acknowledged that managing a small majority makes it very difficult to govern. Furthermore, as dissatisfaction with Johnson gathers steam, no one seems to have a clear idea of who could garner enough support to replace him. But the gamesmanship behind the scenes has been among House members and their allies as people start to position themselves should the Speaker's chair become vacant. Representative Troy E. Nails, Republican Texas, a member of the right-wing House Freedom Caucus, voiced the concern of many conservatives if Johnson is tossed aside. If it's not him, then who can manage this conference? If we're not going to identify a problem with Mike Johnson, I understand. But you have to have a solution, he said. There is not anybody in that room I just walked out of that can manage this conference. Last month, Green filed a motion to eject Johnson after he and a minority of Republicans funded the government based on higher spending levels, agreed to by President Biden and McCarthy last year. Filing such a measure, however, does not force the House to consider it. Green would have to move the motion under special rules triggering a House vote in 48 hours. She would not commit Tuesday to a timeline to force a vote, something that she solely controls. I think it was significant that Massey co-sponsored the motion to vacate, and it also lets people know this is a lot more serious than people realize, Green said. Besides Green, just two other Republicans are needed to oust the Speaker, one more than has publicly declared they would do so. But the margin narrows to one besides Green on Friday when Representative Mike Gallagher, Republican Wisconsin, is planning to resign and the GOP will have a one-seat majority. Green claimed that there are more Republicans who oppose Johnson than the eight who voted to remove McCarthy, though she wouldn't name them. She declared that resigning is really the best choice for the Speaker because otherwise Johnson would have to rely on Democrats to keep his gavel. That would not be a sustainable position for our entire conference. Because we want a Republican speaker, not a Democrat speaker, she told reporters. Democrats have indicated that they may be willing to save Johnson's job if it came to that, but much depends on the final text of his foreign aid package. They helped tank McCarthy's speakership last fall after the former speaker refused to ask for their help. They largely trust Johnson, however, to keep his word, and they respect him for recognizing that compromise is necessary to ensure that high-priority bills land on the president's desk. Many Republicans left Tuesday's meeting frustrated that their colleagues are once again pushing to derail the legislative process and that they may have to rely on the minority party to govern. Republicans are privately griping about what it means to be a conservative lawmaker under such circumstances, and the dysfunction has made some angry that more members are privately telling colleagues they may retire. Conservatives complained about a single member having the power to set demands and dangle threats over the speaker, a condition McCarthy grudgingly accepted to secure the job. Representative Dan Musser, Republican Pennsylvania, argued that such an extreme move was created for situations in which the House leader was caught in scandal or had committed a crime, not this. Not someone being so deliberative and working as hard as Johnson can. I think it's dead wrong. The last thing this country needs is to throw a speaker out. Although I disagree with what he's doing, I wouldn't put the country through that, said Representative Ralph Norman, Republican South Carolina, a member of the Freedom Caucus. Meanwhile, four chairs of House National Security Committees and a subcommittee issued a statement in favor of the Johnson package. They are part of a faction of the Republican conference advocating for foreign policy aid that is often drowned out by the naysayers. There is nothing our adversaries would love more than if Congress were to fail to pass critical national security aid. Representatives Mike McCall, Texas, Mike D. Rogers, Alabama, Michael R. Turner, Ohio, and Tom Cole, Oklahoma, and Ken Calvert, California, said in a statement. But the way forward on the foreign aid bills is also murky. Johnson had delayed for weeks making a decision on the Senate-passed $95 billion national security bill, providing military support for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. He has tried to thread a delicate needle by allocating funding for Ukraine, promising to address border security and attempting to appease some on his right flank. But his effort has fallen largely flat. The speaker is far short of the Republican votes needed to pass the procedural vote, known as a rule, to later this week consider the legislation. Some Republicans are angry that after months of saying border security is the number one priority, despite rejecting an opportunity to consider a bipartisan border security bill earlier this year, the Johnson plan doesn't include it. The speaker, however, indicated that his proposal could either add border language to a foreign aid bill or allow such language to be offered as an amendment. Democrats have signaled they will help pass the procedural motion needed to consider the foreign aid bills, but only if those measures are identical to the Senate-approved package. They've expressed similar sentiments about saving Johnson's job if he moves a robust foreign aid bill. But the situation is extremely fluid, and anything could happen. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat, New York, said Tuesday morning, the Democrats would not support a penny less than what's currently in the Senate bill for humanitarian relief. Democrats have been told that Johnson's bill will include $9 billion in humanitarian aid. The same amount is in the Senate bill, but they're waiting to see the text before communicating a path forward. Republican aides confirmed that humanitarian aid is expected to be in the bill. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby echoed House Democrats, noting that the Pentagon is waiting for more details before announcing whether it backs Johnson's plan. At first blush, he said, it looks like it addresses our needs. Small-time investors in Trump's Truth Social reckon with stock collapse, by Drew Harwell. Jerry Dean McLean first bet on former President Donald Trump's Truth Social 2 years ago, buying into the Trump company's planned merger partner, Digital World Acquisition, at $90 a share. Over time, as the price changed, he kept buying, amassing hundreds of shares for $25,000. Pretty much his whole nest egg, he said. That nest egg has lost more than half its value in the past 2 weeks as Trump Media and Technology Group's share price dropped from $66 after his public debut last month to $22 on Tuesday, but McLean, 71, who owns a tree removal service outside Oklahoma City, said he's not worried. If anything, he wants to buy more. I know good and well it's in Trump's hands, and he's got plans, he said. I have no doubt it's going to explode sometime. For shareholders like McLean, investing in Truth Social is less a business calculation than a statement of faith in the former president and the business traded under his initials DJT. Even the company's plunging stock price and the chance their investments could get mostly wiped out doesn't seem to have shaken that faith. The stock plunged 14% on Tuesday, and the company has lost nearly $5 billion in value since its market debut. As a business, Trump Media has largely underwhelmed. The company lost $58 million last year on a $4 million revenue, less than the average Chick-fil-A franchise, even as it paid out millions to executive salaries, bonuses, and stock. And in 2 years, True Social has attracted a tiny fraction of the traffic other platforms see, according to estimates from the analytics firm SimilarWeb, one of the only ways to measure its performance, given that the company says it does not currently and may never collect, monitor, or report certain key operating metrics used by companies in similar industries. But for some Trump investors, the stock is a badge of honor, a way to show their devotion beyond buying Trump merchandise, visiting Trump golf courses, or donating to Trump's presidential campaign. Trump media spokeswoman Shannon Devine said in a statement that Truth Social has created a free speech beachhead against big tech for a fraction of the startup and operating costs that the legacy tech corporation incurred, while having no debt, more than $200 million in the bank, and the support of hundreds of thousands of retail investors who fervently believe in our mission. Trump media has boasted that it has benefited from a flood of retail investors, small-time and amateur shareholders betting their personal cash. Its merger partner, Digital World Acquisition, said its shares were bought by nearly 400,000 retail investors, and Trump Media's chief executive, Devin Nunes, told Fox News anchor Maria Bartiromo on April 7th that the company had added over 200,000 new ones in the previous couple of weeks. "There's not another company out there that has retail investors like this," said Nunes, who this year will receive a $1 million salary, a $600,000 retention bonus, and a stock package currently worth more than $2.6 million. In an interview last month with conservative commentator Sean Hannity, the former Republican congressman recounted a recent discussion with Trump in which the men celebrated having opened up the Internet and kept it open for the American people. "I'll never forget the conversation we had," Nunes said. He said, "You know, once we're all dead and gone, this will last forever." Many of True Social's investors say they're in it for the long haul. Todd Schlanger, an interior designer at a furniture store in West Palm Beach, who said Trump had been one of his customers, said he's invested about $20,000 in total and is buying new shares every week. Schlanger said he now watches his stock performance every day, hoping for positive signs. In a Truth Social post last week, he encouraged everyone who supports Donald Trump and Truth Social to buy a share every day and asked, "Do you think we have hit bottom?" The stock has slid about 35% since that post. He suspects the recent drops in share price have been the result of stock manipulation from an organized effort to make the company look bad. There's no proof of such a campaign, but Schlanger is convinced. "It's got to be political," he said, "from all the liberals that are trying to knock it down." That range of emotions is on full display on Truth Social, where thousands of mostly anonymous accounts have flocked to meme-filled investor groups, one of which is emblazoned with a computer-generated image showing Trump pumping his fist on a Wall Street trading floor. Some accounts there have recently encouraged traders to keep investing in a fight they said was about good versus evil, a way to defend Trump from the liberal elites laughing at him, and by extension, them. The user, at BaldyLocksUSMC, said, "The fight has been long and hard on most of us, and that this stock is not for the weak, but that one day they would triumph over critics who were brainwashed beyond repair." After the billionaire media mogul Barry Diller called Trump media a scam stock bought by dopes, one account at Handbag 72 claimed to have bought more shares, arguing Diller didn't get it or was at risk of losing many dollars. The next day, the account shared a 2021 blog post from the investing forum Seeking Alpha, saying True Social could be worth $1 trillion in the next 10 years. But there are also flickers of uncertainty and disenchantment, with some saving they faced thousands of dollars in losses or had risked literally everything. One user who had posted "tired of winning yet" earlier this year when the stock Spike posted that the recent losses were painful to stomach. "Come on, DJT, every time I buy more, the price drops," the user at Bill7718 wrote. "When will it be the bottom?" He posted a chart Thursday showing the stock rising slightly alongside the caption, "Moving." The price has since gone back down. The user at ManofPeace123, who said they bought shares at $65 and that 71% of their portfolio was TJT stock, said on Wednesday that investing was a way of telling Trump, "I believe in you and I stand with you through good times and bad." But a day later, the user added, "Can't help but feel sad, feel like I'm trying to catch a falling knife." Another account at Real Jane Blonde posted on April 7th that she was not panicked, not worried before. 2 days later, posting a message to Trump and congressional Republicans urging them to make it illegal to bet against or short sell stocks. "Sick of my investment money being stolen," she wrote. "They're stealing people money and you're allowing it." Some users said they were baffled by the stock's ups and downs, and one asked for advice on how to tell her husband she didn't want to sell. One user posted a meme image saying, "If you're worried about your money, remember this. DJT stock is about free speech, and without free speech, money won't mean much." But other users saw some questions as displays of unacceptable doubt. When the user at Seneca1950 asked whether anyone was concerned that the company's upcoming plans to issue tens of millions more shares would sink the stock price, two accounts criticized the account for spreading FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. "Are you a fudster?" wrote a user named Jesus Revolution 2024. Wrote another, Rebristol, "You must be short with no way out." In moments of apparent despair, some users work to lift one another up by arguing that they are enduring the same kinds of deep state attacks that they had long shadowed Trump himself. When user at Bing Blang Blau said they were embarrassed to be so deep in the red and questioned why everyone was acting like everything is fine, Chad Nedhoen, a Canadian investor and prominent cheerleader of the stock on Truth Social and the video site Rumble, responded, "No one's fine with it, but we are DJT now. The deep state is making their run at Trump and us." The user, however, posted afterward that the argument left him unconvinced. "I'm tired of blaming the deep state," he said. Later he added, "You would think that the biggest political movement of all time would want to support the man leading it and get much better numbers than this." The accounts did not respond to messages and offered no way to contact them. Carol Swain, a prominent conservative commentator in Nashville who previously taught political science at Vanderbilt University, said she invested $1,000 in Trump media stock earlier this month at $48 a share over the objection of her financial advisor who predicted the stock would dive. "If I lose it, fine. If I make a profit, wonderful. But at the end of the day, I wanted to show my support," she said. "There's such an effort to destroy him and strip his wealth away, and so much glee about it. I would like to see him be a winner." She too suspects stock manipulation, arguing that the people who hate Donald Trump would do anything to try to hurt him. As for Truth Social itself, she said she posts there only sparingly and prefers X, where she has 35 times as many followers. "I have always wanted not to just preach to the choir," she said. McLean, the tree service owner in Oklahoma, said he believes the stock could go to $1,000 a share easy once the media stops writing so negatively about it and the company works through its growing pains. "The company's leaders," he said, "are being too silent right now amid questions about the falling share price." But he suspects it's because they're working on something amazing and new. McLean is an amateur trader. He invested only once before and lost his butt, and said he hasn't talked to his family about his investment, saying, "You know how that is," but he believes the Trump media deal is a sign he is supposed to invest, he said. "This isn't just another stock to me. I feel like it was God Almighty that put it in my lap, he said. I've just got to hold on and let them do their job. If you go on emotion, you'll get out of this thing the first time it goes down. At Columbia, Israel-Gaza tensions simmer as leaders face House hearing by Susan Serluga. Most days, the iron gates to Columbia University are wide open, with students hurrying to class along the brick walkways and tossing frisbees on the lawns. But on a recent afternoon, security officers watched as people scanned their school IDs to get in. An unauthorized protest was about to happen. Inside, a phalanx of students suddenly appeared alongside the school's administration building, marching in black with keffiyehs covering their faces. Another masked group appeared on the other side, descending the stairs. Soon, protesters were massed at the center of campus, holding signs with messages such as "Globalize the Intifada." Xavier Westergaard, a doctoral candidate in biology, walked through the pro-Palestinian group wearing a hamaka, evoking the bright blue and white of Israel's flag, sat down facing the protesters, and began reading Psalms aloud. A few tried to drown out the rally with a bullhorn. An Israeli professor kept demanding that university officials monitoring the event explain why it wasn't being shut down. The campus had been warned that students could be disciplined for attending the unauthorized demonstration. Some had just been suspended for a previous event, but protesters kept coming. "We will honor the martyrs," a tightly masked speaker called out. Protesters spoke of the deadly bombing of a hospital in Gaza, and using a phrase heard by some as a Palestinian rallying cry and by others as an outright call to annihilate Israel, chanted, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." 6 months after the Hamas attack, tensions over the Israeli-Gaza war remain raw on college campuses, and administrators continue to face questions over their responses to protests such as this one. At Columbia, a university with a long history of student activism, some are asking whether the school is now censoring and stifling freedom of expression or has repeatedly failed to protect vulnerable students from hatred. On Wednesday, focus on what's happening on the campus will intensify as Columbia President Manucci Shafik will face questions from lawmakers about whether the university has done enough to combat anti-Semitism. That is all the time we have for today. This is Anne saying goodbye, and I'll talk with you again soon.
And that concludes today's reading of the Washington Post. This reading was made available by the Talking Information Center in Massachusetts. Learn more at ticnetwork.org.